Hello, and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, episode 39. This is the comics podcast. We cover all the latest and greatest comic book news. We review comics here, and we also have special guests. And I am once again joined by a man who's been gone for a little bit, but he's back again. His name is Forrest.
Hello, this is Forrest with two R's, and John Mayer said your body is a wonderland, but mine is a junkyard. It's because, to bounce back from our fantastic wedding and honeymoon, I was drinking a two-year expired Red Bull
just a couple minutes ago. Oh, yes.
And I can feel my body shutting down.
Do you think you have wings, or is it something else, something grotesque? Tentacles? Red Bull gives you tentacles.
It feels like wet rocks are building in my stomach.
Oh, no, that's not good.
So, hey, that's a little personal. Hi, everyone. How are you doing?
We're good. We're all good, I think. We're going to have a bit of a shorter regular show because we have Cammy Garcia on, who will be talking about Joker Harley, her new upcoming comic that comes out October 9th. We get into serial killers. We talk about, obviously, Harley. We talk about profiling Joker, which is probably one of the more fascinating things I've ever heard. She's taking it very serious and writing a series that is very, very serious, very realistic. So if you hang on, you can hear that interview a little bit later in the show. But to start our show, every show, we talk about the latest news, the stuff that everybody's buzzing about. And this week, in one of the bigger pieces of news, though it's small, James Tynion IV is taking over Batman with Batman number 86. And he'll be writing it until Batman number 100. And at that point, DC will find another writer. But this is quite big because Tom King has been writing Batman for such a long time now. So great job, James. He was on the show a few weeks ago to talk about his new Boom series, Something is Killing the Children. And, you know, it couldn't go to a better guy. He's been co-writing Justice League with Scott Snyder, and it's been epic and impressive. His run on Detective Comics was also fantastic. And yeah, he's just a great fit for this, and it makes a lot of sense to give him the next 14 or so issues until Batman number 100, which will bring us to about summer 2020, unless they speed up the release schedule. And in our next bit of news, Marvel released their full solicitations, which, of course, has everybody abuzz in multiple ways. There's all sorts of new information coming out about the comics coming out December 2019. Marvel's very good at releasing information about this before the full solicits come out. So we already know a bunch of things that were in this article. If you go to aiptcomics.com, you can read our full solicitations for December 2019. Like, for instance, we already had the information about Incoming, number one, which is some big time new murder mystery series from almost every big time creator that Marvel has.
Yeah, I think probably spearheaded by Al Ewing out of Marvel Comics 1000,
yes,
right?
Yes, because it involves the Eternity Mask.
Yes, the kind of central story to Marvel Comics 1000, or the only recurring story there. So that makes sense. My immediate thought about Incoming, and this is a little harsh, but I'm back, I'm new, I got a new edge. Why J. Scott Campbell still get to make comic cover?
Clearly it's offended you so much that you can't get the words out.
Why you do? If you guys head over to aiptcomics.com and check out our solicits article, which Dave mentioned earlier, the very top image for Incoming number one is a J. Scott Campbell cover, and all of the men are like bulky and stylized, admittedly, like maybe a little over stylized, big chest Rob Liefeld style, but all of the women look like they've had all of their internal organs sucked out.
Yeah, their waists are like 3 inches thick.
On Twitter, I said that Black Widow looks like the alien that made the clone army in Star Wars.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And needless to say, that tweet is doing pretty well.
Yeah, he took some flack for it. I saw someone, you know, ripping him a new one on Twitter, and he kind of comically replied saying that their profile image was an image he drew.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that.
I was like, oof, yeah, you got to be a little more aware of when you're trashing someone, what you're into. But yeah, and he got a little flack for the Black Widow cover as well, because it's like a full-on butt shot.
Nightwing-style butt shot.
We didn't have this on the agenda, but the Nightwing butt shot was actually talked about quite a bit this week.
I love it. It was the number three trending on Twitter for like 2 days.
Right, which is, you know, that's pretty big for comics. We're not
Nightwing thick.
Yeah, he who drew that, by the way? I forget. Oh, Nicola Scott.
That butt so good made me forget artist.
You know, because this came out this week, it feels like I feel like J. Scott Campbell could get away with a crazy black cat butt shot.
I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it. I tend to think that comics depictions of women are still pretty shitty.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of bleeds into the marketing for, like, the Marvel Universe movies, at least the posters and stuff. And I think that there's a lot of really, really deeply ingrained inherent problems with how women are treated in the industry as people, and then also in marketing and in comics and stuff. And so I don't necessarily feel like it's the same thing. But I will say that I think Black Cat and Nightwing have good butts.
But they don't have America's ass.
It all comes out in the wash. They do not have America's ass.
Okay, so other news that came out, Annihilation Scourge, this seemingly event, is coming out, and it looks like Matthew Rosenberg is sort of spearheading it. He has two books.
Yeah, interesting. I found that very interesting that it was Matty Rosenberg.
Yeah.
Because obviously Donny Cates is tackling Guardians of the Galaxy right now, and you can't really have a cosmic event like this without Guardians of the Galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I was pretty surprised, but him and Donnie are really, really good friends. Donnie's busy with whatever's going on in Carnage, whatever's happening in Venom after Carnage. So it makes a little more sense than it looks like on paper.
And I mean, they have Dan Abnett joining in, which
is
huge because he was all about Annihilation, the original Annihilation.
Yes, I love Dan Abnett's work. I love him on cosmic stuff at Marvel. I love his Warhammer 40K books. That's actually probably the only reason I'm interested in this event.
Nice, yeah. And if you actually, there's actually a really good article by one of our writers, Ritesh Babu, about a book that Dan Abnett just wrote. He's basically created the Guardians of the Galaxy in the DC universe, and he's doing it so overtly that it's almost a joke,
almost intentional. Yeah,
yeah. It's worth a look. I think it was Justice League Odyssey is the title. There's a guy that's like basically named Star Lord, but it's like Space Lord or something.
Yeah,
and instead of a raccoon, there's a cat. So
yeah.
Other stuff that popped up, X-Men. There's a lot of X-Men news because there's new covers coming out for the third and fourth issues of all of these new Dawn of X books.
There's some pretty fantastic Rod Reese art for the New Mutants books.
Yes,
That reminds me a lot of Bill Sienkiewicz, so that's really exciting.
Some little tidbits that came out in the solicit information. It seems as if not every mutant has gone to Krakoa. Some people are refusing to go. Armor is sort of tasked with maybe pulling in more people to join the mutant cause, or nation, I should say. And then there's some there's some pirate high seas action going on in Marauders.
Marauders, yeah.
Not really sure who they're fighting.
And also the pirate book.
Yeah, exactly. And then meanwhile in X-Force, it appears as if maybe a mutant has been killed by humans, and their job is to fucking beat them up, fight back.
Yep. Yeah, covert op style, find out who did it, why,
yep,
type thing. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. That's pretty neat. I'm into that. I will tell you the one thing that I was immediately turned off by in these solicits, and folks, there's like 140 covers.
Yeah, it's a lot.
There's quite a bit. I'm pretty vocal about my preference for Marvel on the show, and definitely my own reading habits. And so a lot of this I really like, I'm really excited about. There's a book called Punisher Soviet,
mm-hmm,
written by Garth Ennis with art by Jason Burroughs. Mm-hmm. It has like a very, very like USSR propaganda style cover.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate this.
Why do you hate it? You like Putin? You're pro Putin.
It says seeds planted decades ago in Moscow and Afghanistan bloom bloody in New York City. Who is Valery Stepanovich? And why did he mow down a room full of Russian mobsters? These are questions Frank Castle is going to answer and then decide if Valery deserves his own punishment. Folks, this is like, I don't know why I keep saying folks, like I'm J. Jonah Jameson. This is like old school style Russophobia. Mm-hmm. This is like Red Scare shit. Mm-hmm. And I get that like Punisher is like edgy. He's not even really a hero. He's maybe not even an anti-hero. Depending on how you look at him, he may be a straight up and down villain. And it's not necessarily a sympathetic character or a storyline or anything like that. But it just bums me out to see Marvel like buying into how easy it is to market and make money on Russophobia right now.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of, I don't know. I don't know.
You know, when I was in film school, I did this whole paper on how there was, you know, anti-Russian stuff going on with film, mm-hmm, for a while.
Yep.
And then it kind of started to shift towards the Middle East and like terrorism. And there's some really god-awful 90s anti-terrorist movies.
Yep.
Yeah, I guess maybe it's shifting. It's shifting back. And Garth Ennis is trying to capture that. I don't know.
The pendulum swings. We've always got to have an enemy.
You're a menace, Ennis.
That's pretty good. Folks. Garth Ennis is a menace.
There you go. Enough said.
What were you most excited by? in these solicits?
Probably the X-Men stuff. There was more details in that, like giving us hints at what's going on
in House of X and Powers of Ten. Mm-hmm, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with the whole 2099 thing. I'm a little nervous because Spencer's sort of spearheading it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But with Chip Zdarsky doing Doom 2099, and then we've got Jody Houser doing Venom 2099, I mean, there's some really there's some top talent in there.
Some really good folks in there, absolutely, yeah. I'm very excited for Scream, Curse of Carnage, written by Clay McLeod Chapman. Mm-hmm. I've always really liked Scream, even as kind of a non-character in, like, Lethal Protector.
Yeah.
And I find her Absolute Carnage tie-in right now probably the weakest. But I thought that Clay McLeod Chapman's Separation Anxiety book was the strongest tie-in to Absolute Carnage yet.
Really scary.
So I'm really, really excited for that. Vita Ayala on Morbius. And then...
Oh, those covers are amazing, too.
Yeah. And obviously, as a Spider-Man fan, I'm going to get really into Jed Mackey's Spider-Verse, even if the editorial misstep there annoys me.
Right, right. I'm not excited, but I'm very curious. The solicits seem to suggest Star Wars is doing a full reboot in December.
Yeah, pretty much every other book has ended.
Right.
Dr. Aphra is like the only one left, and it's ending with this Star Wars saga book. So that Star Wars saga book seems to be kind of wrapping up the first wave, I guess, of Star Wars comics. Mm-hmm. And they're going to have to go somewhere new.
The timing is really good for New York Comic Con for them to blow our minds with whatever's going to happen next.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's Star Wars in particular is a fully integrated marketing machine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, of course they're ending this because of Rise of Skywalker is coming out.
Right, right.
You know, they've got to put... They're going to make some movie covers. They're going to show us one new character who will be in 2 seconds of the movie, but is a much bigger deal in the comics. They're going to make action figures. They're going to make, you know, it's like a well-oiled machine at this point. So I think time-wise, it totally makes sense.
Totally, yeah. And, you know, a lot of their books have been taking place between Empire and New Hope, so I'm wondering if they'll move the main series to a different era.
Mm.
Maybe later. Mm. I mean, mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is the movies are kind of, we know they're ending for a while, so.
Yeah, I think that's the end of this new trilogy gives them a really good opportunity to tell new stories while fans are eager for it.
Right, yeah. Anywho, it's not all about Marvel solicits on this show, guys. In our next bit of news...
Yeah, everyone who just talked about it for almost 20 minutes.
Calm down! DC's Birds of Prey canceled. DC Birds of Prey resolicited as mature title. What?
Yep. Yeah, this is interesting. Yeah. They totally canceled it, and then they resolicited it as a mature reader's black label title.
Do you think Brian Azzarello put another dick in there?
Oh my god, I fucking forgot he's writing this.
He is, yes.
I don't really want to talk about this anymore. maybe there's a dick.
Could be.
You know, I will say that this is... I was really, really stoked about the new stuff that they had announced for Black Label.
Mm-hmm.
Like that dark fantasy book. I can't remember who's writing it right now. Some other superhero books. They're doing all this Joker and Harley stuff, which has actually so far turned out much better than I expected. This feels like the first or the most recent pretty negative PR for Black Label, mm-hmm. where it's like... We're taking, it's really funny money because DC's taking from themselves and giving to themselves.
Right.
But canceling books that were intended for the direct market and then putting on them on your like adults only shelf.
Yeah.
Is weird.
They must have, story-wise, it was just leaning towards something too dark. You know, it's actually interesting. When I talked to Cammy Garcia about Joker Harley, which is later in the show, she went to DC and wanted to do a YA book about Joker. And eventually they got around to doing a Harley book. And then they were like, wait, this is way too twisted and dark and adult to put in a mainline book.
Mm-hmm. Well, and DC is really into that age brackets thing right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah. That's
so
true.
I get it conceptually what they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think the age brackets are kind of fuzzily defined, but I get the general idea.
Mm-hmm.
I just think ultimately it looks bad.
You look bad, DC. You look so bad. And in our next bit of news, you look even worse. DC ends its co-op advertising program, which...
Yeah.
Tell us about this, Forrest.
Sucks. So DC used to have, or still has until December 31st, 2019... a co-op advertising program with local comic book shops, LCSs, where if an LCS bought DC marketing materials, posters, cardboard cutouts, I think even like long boxes and short boxes and stuff, DC would give the retailer a discount on their book orders that was, you know, relevant or relative to the amount of advertising that they were doing for DC. On December 31st, 2019, and going into 2020, DC is completely ending this partnership. There will be no incentivization at all to put DC books in your shop. I don't know the status of returnability. That might be a thing, which basically encourages comic shops to over-order books because they can return anything that they don't sell. But without anything to advertise those books, it's kind of like pulling the plug on both of them.
Yeah, it seems very weird, like a bad idea for marketing.
It seems like a bad idea. I know that comic book readers need to be found in other places these days, you know, digital, DC's own publishing service, Comixology, whatever it is, right? Or even the TKO style where you get the whole run in one box. But you can't completely forget about your core demographic for a new one.
It seems like, we'll see what happens next, but it seems like they're slowly pulling their presence out of comic stores, right?
It does seem that way to me, yeah.
Which is not good for the industry, folks. Not good.
It's not. It's not good for DC. It's not good for retailers. It's not good for artists.
In our last bit of news, Archie Comics has bought a corporate... No, sorry.
Yep, corporate membership.
Yeah, corporate membership.
The Comic Book Legal Defense Fund.
Yes, which makes me think they're going to start suing Marvel and DC every second. No, I'm just kidding.
The Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, for folks that don't know, is like a... it's kind of like a First Amendment group that protects the freedom for people to read comics and have comics in school libraries and public libraries and use them for conferences and stuff like that. It's a partner with Banned Books Week and the Kids Right to Read Project. There are a ton of other publishers that are already members. Boom, Comixology, Dark Horse, DC. I don't know that Marvel is, but they're also notoriously careful with their brand image. So there's a bunch of people that are already a member of this, but it seems pretty cool to welcome Archie to the family. And
yeah, for sure. It was like 2 weeks ago now when the whole Brazil thing came up. We talked about it on the show. The mayor basically trying to outlaw a comic because he didn't agree with what was inside of it.
Yeah.
It's just a reminder of how important the CBLDF is.
Yeah. I think this is really good PR for Archie. I think it's pretty cool. I'm happy about it. I don't have an interesting or unique take aside from seems good.
Seems good, which is, you know, interesting because in our next segment, we're going to get even deeper into seems good and talk a little bit more.
More gooder.
In our top books of last week, we're going to talk about our top favorite two books of last week. And since we have a guest on, we are going to keep our number two picks down to one sentence. But to start this segment, we always talk about comicbookroundup.com. No, they do not pay us to say this, and they should. The Rotten Tomatoes of comic book
should
reviews.
They?
Yes, damn it.
Should they?
I want money. We start this segment by always talking about the top critic pick and the top fan pick. The top fan pick, no surprise, House of X number 5 by Jonathan Hickman and Pepe Larraz. And we might be talking about that a bit later. And then we have, for the critic pick, The Weatherman Volume 2 number 4 by Jody LaHoop and Nathan Fox. Cool, cool. I haven't been reading The Weatherman. Yeah. This is like
I have not either.
Yet another book where I'm like, I'm going to read that someday.
Yeah, obviously everyone under the sun is reading House of X, but it's pretty cool to see Weatherman pull ahead like that.
For sure. Yeah. Forrest, what is your second favorite book out last week?
My second favorite book out last week is Absolute Carnage, number 3, written by Donny Cates with art by Ryan Stegman. If that surprises you, you don't know me at all.
Go away.
My one sentence review is scary, subversive, and surprisingly silly. This is the strongest Marvel event in years.
Whoa. High praise. Years, he says. So that's a lot. That's a lot of years. How many years are we talking? Give us the exact amount.
Oh, boy.
Since Civil War.
If we're not counting... I got it. That's what I was going to say.
Damn. Sorry.
We're not counting House of X and Powers of 10 as an event, since Civil War.
Nice. I love the fact that it's a hard... We'll talk about it in a bit. My second favorite pick is Lex Luthor, Year of the Villain by Jason Latour and Brian Hitch. I reviewed this at aptcomics.com. Go read it. Here's the last sentence of that review. Hitch's art gives us this event, and Hitch's art gives this an event feel, while the story is fun in ways only comics can achieve, thanks to Latour's imaginative ideas. It's basically a little ride through Elseworld Lex Luthor's and what they're doing.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I like the whole Year of the Villain idea. I think it's neat.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to link all of these one shots together while also telling their own stories.
Yeah.
Marvel should maybe try that sometime. Not make every tie-in a must read. Because you don't have to read these to really get it.
Yeah. And then they go too far the other way. Like, Acts of Evil doesn't seem connected to itself at all.
Right, right.
So, I don't know. My number one pick was House of X number 5, written by Jonathan Hickman, with art by Pepe Larraz. This is the penultimate issue of House of X.
Dun-dun-dun.
We'll be getting the penultimate issue of Powers of 10, I think, next week. This is a fantastic, fantastic comic. It's unsettling. It's uncanny. It's a little scary. You get this kind of continued nationalistic feel to the new X-Men nation. But also, I think I find them entirely sympathetic as a queer person who's been marginalized in a lot of spaces and in a lot of conversations and interactions with people. And so I really like this tightrope walk they're doing between, like, this is very intended to make you uncomfortable, but what if you were there? And what if you needed to be there and you were part of it, part of mutantdom? And how would you feel if things like Genosha had happened to you? What would you need to do to protect yourself and your society? And I just find the whole idea so inherently interesting. I think Hickman is really knocking it out of the park. Pepe Larraz's art is fantastic. And as always, Marty Garcia's coloring is really, really amazing and ties these two different stories together thematically incredibly well.
Standout series. I was talking to Vishal, who's reviewed the last few issues at AIPTComics.com, about the book, and it's like it set such a high bar that it's amazing compared to most books, but when you start to compare it to itself, then you realize like how high that bar is. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. My brother-in-law texted me earlier this week because he's been reading it as well. And he was like, you know, I feel like I like other comics, but they're kind of like junk food.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what I'm reading in House of X and Powers of 10 is like, I need to taste the rootiness of this wine.
Nice.
You know?
Yeah, that's a good way of saying
and
it.
And I was like, yeah, for sure. I find myself thinking about these books throughout the whole week.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and I think I said this on another show. Like, it's almost like Lost in that it's got you thinking about, oh, what could happen next and oh, what's going on here.
Yeah.
And that's a big part of the fun of this 12-week awesomeness.
Yes. And I think next week we will talk about how the folks behind Lost could never pull off a comic of this caliber.
Yes. J.J. Abrams. The Spider-Man book this week. We'll talk about that next week.
We will talk about that next week. Dave, what was your number one book this week?
Your number two book, Absolute Carnage number 3 by Donny Cates and Ryan Stegman. I haven't been reviewing it. You've been reviewing the series.
I reviewed
this issue. I really liked it. It's a reminder that most events are just big action things, and this is a horror thing. And that's what I was really kind of enamored with this issue. It's just very creepy. There's like a good amount of tension. The visuals can get into this sort of visceral horror element, like in the first page where Miles is sort of falling into this pit of blood and blackness.
Yeah, it's really good.
Just so creepy, and it's just doing it all so well. And it's coming out at the right time. We're almost into October, yep. Folks.
Yeah.
Super scary.
Oh, man, I think it's going to really hit a crescendo.
It's 6 issues, right?
It's 6, five.
5 issues.
5 issues.
Oh, shoot. Yep. We only have 2 more left, guys.
Two more. Yeah, I really think it's going to hit a crescendo that's just going to be amazing. And as you said, perfectly timed for the spooky seasons.
It's a dish of delightful horrors. In our next segment, Top Books for Next Week, we talk about the number one book we're looking forward to coming out next week, September 25th, to be exact. My most anticipated book is The White Trees number 2 by Chip Zdarsky and Chris Anka. This is a 2-issue story, which you don't usually see.
Yeah, you don't ever get the, like, this is just going to be the other half.
Right.
Like, how satisfying.
So satisfying. Because you're like, yes, my buy-in is so low, but each issue is actually extra size, too.
And there's a lot of dong.
There is. There's quite a bit in one scene. And that's actually part of the reason why I want to read it, because that scene is very well done. It's very creative, but also very adult. And it's basically taking an adult view on, like, a fantasy genre. And it feels very original in that. Even though it's so short, it still feels very robust in its world building.
This is the kind of book that I would be happy to see on Black Label because it is mature, it is interesting, it is artistic. This handles mature content in such a more artistic and thoughtful way. I think Birds of Prey will.
The Last God, though, from DC Black Label, that is fantasy.
Yes.
That might hit those.
Yeah, that looks really
good.
That
might scratch your
itch. That is the book I was talking about earlier. Thank you.
Yes. So what is your most anticipated book out next week?
My most anticipated book is a Vault number one. It's The Plot number one, written by Michael Morecki with Tim Daniel. And the art is by Josh Hickson, who I really liked on Shanghai Red with Chris Sabella last year. Mm-hmm. This is a book, it's kind of like Haunting of Hill House a little bit. They've said that it is aesthetically evocative of that and also narratively evocative of that, or at least of Shelley Johnson's other novels. And basically the idea is that an uncle ends up adopting his niece and nephew after his sibling dies. And to take care of them, he moves into a family house, a giant manse that appears to be haunted or corroding them both internally and externally. Just a straight up and down horror story with some really cool, interesting gothic elements that remind me of like Crimson Peak or obviously Haunting of Hill House.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I'm excited for it.
Maybe we should all read it.
We should all read it.
You know, something that makes you buy a book sometimes is the cover. Just the cover. And that's why in our next segment, Judging by the Cover Junior, we talk about our favorite cover of books coming out next week. And Forrest, what is your favorite cover art?
My favorite cover art for next week is The New Mutants War Children number one. This is written by Chris Claremont, and the cover art, as well as the internal art, thank God, is by Bill Sienkiewicz. This cover is really, really cool. It seems like the story is going to be about Warlock being corrupted in some way and like trying to kill the rest of the New Mutants, or maybe even like a split personality type thing. You've got this really kind of like thin and scary Warlock face. It's just like teeth and claws clamping down on the New Mutants magic and Sunspot. But also Warlock is there looking up at himself in kind of this scared, exaggerated expression. And it seems like he's the only one that sees this kind of giant monolithic threat wrapping around them. It's really, really interesting. Thematically, I think it probably ties into the story that they want to tell. I always love a cover that does that. And then also Bill Sienkiewicz's art is just so stylized and amazing. You and I were talking earlier, and I said, Bill Sienkiewicz is one of the only comics artists still working today where I could see his art and say, that's Bill Sienkiewicz. Mm-hmm. Even if it was completely removed of context or anything like that. Like you said, up on a gallery wall.
Yeah.
It's very, very artistic. It's very, very stylized. It's a little bit nostalgic, obviously, if you're reading like the Demon Bear Saga, which I love. But it's also, it feels new and fresh and exciting.
Yeah, it's like a work of art. It is a work of art.
Yeah, it is.
My favorite cover was from Powers of X number 5. It's a variant by Mike Huddleston, and it features Apocalypse sort of standing in the what I assume is the Savage Land jungle with a Tyrannosaurus Rex behind him. And this weird, like, monolith kind of thing that almost like celestial-like standing in front of him. Anyway, the colors are a bit muted. If you go to aiptcomics.com, you can actually see the full cover. The colors are a bit muted, and the way Apocalypse is drawn, it's almost like Mike Mignola inspired the design of it, because it's
I love that.
It's somewhat awkward. Like his proportions are somewhat off. Like his head is sort of tiny and his body is so huge. And then the inking on the body is like very pronounced and almost angular at times, where his like usually his those big wheel things on his shoulders are like just smooth and like circular, but here it's like angular and kind of, I don't know. It's really cool. And it makes Apocalypse kind of pop out from this very realistic rendering of the jungle behind him. It's a nice cover. I like it.
Yeah, I think it's really neat. I like Apocalypse a lot. Probably second only to Mr. Sinister.
All right, guys. In our next segment, we will have Cami Garcia on with me. I'm going to be asking her questions about her new series, Joker Harley, Criminal Sanity. And that comes out October 9th. She's also working with artists Mike Mayhew and Miko Swan, who are doing some exceptional work. I've gotten a chance to look at the book. And if you don't know who Cami Garcia is, she recently did Teen Titans Raven for DC Zoom. She's written some fantastic books, some of which were involved in series you might know, like The X-Files. So yeah, we're gonna have a lot of fun. It's about 35 minutes of talking about serial killers and Joker and Harley. So, Cami, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, first off, I got a glimpse of the first issue. No spoilers. The art is, of course, just gorgeous. But also the depiction of Harley Quinn. I really love what you're doing. And she's a lot different from Harley that we've seen in other comic series. She's very serious. And I just want to ask, what went into writing Harley in this way?
Well, she is a forensic psychiatrist and a behavior analyst, which is my consultant for this project, Dr. Edward Kurtz, he is actually both of those things.
Hmm.
And it's, you know, I mean, she had to go to medical school. It's very hardcore. She's very, very intelligent. So I really wanted to write a version of her that would be true to someone with that training, but also true to someone who would be a formidable adversary for the Joker, because she is a profiler. She is the one hunting him. And if you're a serial killer, it's not particularly threatening if the person hunting you is an idiot.
Right.
So I wanted someone who would be a threat, but I also wanted her, I wanted her to have some of the kind of emotional toughness that I feel like a lot of women see in her as a touchstone. There are a lot of women who see her as a survivor and identify with that.
Right, right.
I experienced violence after I broke up with someone after high school, and I was stalked. And so I know what it's like, what dating violence is like. It's very scary. And I think that for a lot of women who have been physically or emotionally abused, either, you know, as kids or as adults, you know, Harley's a survivor, and she kind of represents that, like, you will come out the other side. Hmm. So I also wanted to have some of that. I wanted her to have this kind of survivor spirit and a mental and physical toughness that would enable her to be able to, you know, go toe-to-toe with someone like the Joker.
That's really fascinating. And, you know, you're so right. There's so many people that connect with Harley in that way. And to take it in a more serious light, I think, well, I don't know. It's definitely something that I think the audience kind of craves.
Well, I didn't want to take that away. I didn't want right. to, you know, take away the character, you know, that people identify with after those experiences. If anything, I wanted to make her stronger.
Right, right.
And more formidable and kind of like, you know, the next evolution.
Right. There are elements, I don't want to spoil anything, but there are elements we learn about her where you kind of respect her even more because of like what she does for a day job and stuff like that. I'm just captivated by the way you're writing it. And then on the other hand, this book's also about serial killers in a sense. I'm curious, why do you think the public is so fascinated with, some might dub, evil people?
Yeah, I think there are different reasons. I think, you know, there's a fascination and kind of an inability to fathom how someone could do some of these things, which was what kind of informed my backstory for the Joker was that idea of like, you know, there are psychopaths that never kill anyone.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of CEOs and surgeons and lawyers who are psychopaths. So it's like, what flips that switch? What's different, you know, what makes a boy become a monster or a girl become a monster?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is fascinating in kind of a morbid way of like, it's awful, but also like, we want to understand how it works, how it happens. But then I think there's also a lot of romanticizing of serial killers. You know, we see portrayals where they act charming and, you know, kind of smart and intellectual. And yes, there are a few Ted Bundys who were decent looking and could behave and be charming and act perfectly normal, but that's actually rare. Most serial killers were not charmers. A lot of them didn't even have that high of IQs. So someone like the Joker is more of like an American Psycho version where like he's an anomaly because he is a genius. He's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
So even if he's not charming, you know, he could play charming if he wants. He can play anything.
On the flip side, is Harley a genius, would you say? Or
yes. So Harley is very, very smart in this. She went to college at 14. She is top of her game. I felt like it was really important for her to be on kind of an even intellectual footing. Honestly, like becoming a forensic psychiatrist, the amount of training that you need, you know, because you're also an MD, the amount of training you need and practical experience, it's not a joke. It's really hard. So I think you have to be very intelligent. And then my consultant, Ed, works in like basically an Arkham, and he's also worked in, wow, you know, the Baltimore Arkham. And, you know, to even work in those settings, like you have to be very savvy. You have to be very, you know, smart and analytical because the place he works now, a lot of the guys are not cuffed. They walk around with him.
Oh, interesting.
So, like, you know, you're putting yourself in danger. And I think, obviously, even hunting a serial killer, you see in the book, she's not always with the cops. Sometimes she's by herself.
Right.
So you have to be really smart to be able to do this job. And I wanted it to be very realistic. So the kind of person who would be able to hunt a killer of the Joker's caliber would have to be very intelligent.
Right. And for someone to write this, they have to be very intelligent, wouldn't they?
Well, I appreciate that, but it's hard to write.
I remember, I was at the San Diego Comic-Con panel, the DC Black Label panel, and stop me if I'm wrong. I think you were telling us about, because I was there, you were telling us about how your father was in the CIA, was that right?
No. My stepdad was an undercover cop in DC for 20 years.
And he would duct tape your hands. Could you talk about that a little bit?
No, he didn't duct tape my hands, but he taught me how to get out of hand.
Exactly.
Like that.
Right.
But he did. Yeah, because it was the 70s and yeah. Adam Walsh had disappeared and
right.
He really believed, you know, that I guess also because he worked in a very bad part of DC, mm-hmm. and he really saw people at their worst. There's a lot of people who are naive and think there aren't that many dangerous people out there in the world, and most people are good, but that's actually not really true. Mm. There are a ton of dangerous people in the world.
Right. Your neighbors.
Yeah, there just are, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look up the sex offender registry in your neighborhood, trust me, it is eye-opening. So, like, there are dangers, and I think my stepdad just, you know, he wanted, you know, to know that if something happened, I would know how to handle myself. And it was weird because I always made fun of him and my friends did for thinking he was so weird to make us do all this stuff. But then when I was like 24, I lived alone. I lived in an apartment. Maybe I was 22. I don't remember. I was in my very early 20s. Which is a long time ago. I woke up and there was a dude in my house that I didn't know.
Oh my God.
Like in my room.
Yeah.
And I got out like unscathed, no therapy needed. And it was 100% because of his ridiculous training, because it's like the military, like the minute the emergency situation happens,
right?
Like your mind starts going through the checklist. So it's kind of like, you know, you practice CPR so that in the emergency, you'll be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same kind of thinking, you know,
right.
And it works.
You can like get around your like fight or flight.
Yes.
And start to like actually plan and stuff. That's interesting.
Yeah. But again, I don't think I would have been able to do it if it wasn't so ingrained, because I was literally mentally ticking things off like the list.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's interesting.
And so I think if it wasn't really, if it wasn't kind of formative, all that training, I wouldn't have been able to do that. But I think that's why police, military people, they do repetitive training and they do practice scenarios so often, because then it does become really automatic.
Right. It probably helps you kind of think about how a character might act too.
Yes.
When you're writing. I have to say, I know Dan Didio said this in an interview somewhere, that you basically brought on to profile Joker in more or less. And I'm curious, what goes into that? Do you think about other serial killers and kind of take from different types? Or do you start from whole cloth and just go at it? What goes into profiling someone like the Joker?
I really started with what I believe about him.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I wanted to do was just kind of amplify all of that so that he would be as real as possible. I really wanted it. But one of the things I said in the pitch meeting, I was with Bob Harris and Dan Didio and Jim Lee. I said, I want him to feel so real that like if people read this at night, like before they go to bed, they check to make sure their door's locked.
Jeez.
So honestly, I could not have done that without Ed Kurtz, my, you know, my consultant, because basically I had this profile and I knew certain traits just from like my own knowledge, but then I would, you know, I would test them out, or I would say to Ed and I kind of did it for fun because it was like, we could profile the Joker.
Right.
And we didn't sort of profile him. We did profile him. Like it was part of my pitch. And one of the things that, you know, when I asked him to be the consultant and help with this and really conceive of some of these things, one of the things I said early on, and he holds me to, is I said, I want this to be forensically accurate. So if we create the profile, I want to make sure, and Dan said this, he's like, I want to see these things where I could draw them back to the profile. I could see the profile in action. Mm. I could see these behaviors. And sometimes I'll have an idea that I think is really cool, especially in the beginning when I kind of, now that I've spent so many hours talking to Ed, like sometimes I know what kind of can predict what he might say. But before that, I would say, I want to have him do this. And he would be like, you can't have him do that. And I was like, why? And he's like, well, based on the murder scenes that you want or the kind of killer we're saying he is, like once, you know, the it doesn't go back to the profile. And so we actually also profiled Harley Quinn.
Ooh, interesting.
But no one has ever seen that yet.
Ooh.
Because again, like I had to reverse engineer her because I knew what I wanted her to be like in the end. With the Joker, I kind of took from different versions of him that felt really true to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Heath Ledger portrayal always felt really true to me because I definitely feel like the Joker is much scarier sane than insane.
Oh, for sure.
And I also feel like he's very smart and very resourceful. And I could see him just this unpredictable behavior and doing these things because, you know, just to see what would happen or just to challenge himself or just because he feels like it. And all of that feels very true to the character to me versus like doing something because he's crazy or he's, you know, delusional. I see him as very much sane. And maybe he might act crazy, but if he does, that's a choice.
Interesting. Yeah. So it's like there's a whole other layer of complexity there.
Yeah. And I just also think, again, one of the things that people find very disturbing about guys like Bundy and Gacy and, you know, the, you know, BTK killer, Dennis Rader, like these guys are not criminally insane.
Mm-hmm.
They're sane. They're depraved and sick, but they are not insane. And to me, that is scarier than a person who is suffering from like a mental illness or having hallucinations and feels like their life is in danger and is killing someone, you know, because they believe people are after them. That's a very different thing than like, I feel like, you know, I feel like going hunting tonight.
Generally speaking, it's hard to get away with so many murders unless you're really smart, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
Right. Right.
And actually like Ed Gein, you know, who Leatherface is based on, a lot of Buffalo Bill and Silence of the Lambs. Like he had a very, very low IQ. He only for sure killed two women, but he was also grave robbing and making things out of other women who had recently died,
uh-huh.
Which is gross. But, and he's actually more known for that than for just killing the two women.
Interesting.
But again, like this is a person who was not trying to hide their, when they came in, like it was all there for them to see. He was not evading the police or trying to hide anything. Whereas, you know, Bundy went to great lengths to deceive the police and to hide his crimes. So did Gacy.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like most serial killers are not as intelligent as, you know, movies lead you to believe.
Mm-hmm.
And most serial killers are not like Bundy. You know, like most of them are on the kind of lower end of the spectrum.
When you're profiling Joker, is there like paperwork you fill out or something like that?
Well, there would be if I didn't have Ed. But Ed is, he knows the entire classification system.
Gotcha.
So Ed is my paperwork. So basically with what we do is I will say, you know, I want him, he's going to do things like this. And Ed will say, okay, well, if you do things like that, then you're not a sadist, you're not sadistic, but you're a narcissist, or you're a psychopath, but you're not a sexual sadist, you know, like BTK. So when I would kind of talk about the behaviors or what I want him to be like, he would then explain to me, well, that puts you in this category, but not this category. And then if I would say something else, he might say, okay, but this puts you into this territory. And I'd be like, no, I don't want that territory. So basically, like, if it's like volleyball, you know, like I would say I want him to do something. And Ed's like, literally like the encyclopedia, who says, okay, well, this means that.
Interesting.
Do you like that? No. But also Ed is a comics buff. So, which is the really unique thing that I had going for me. Like, I mean, he has a collection. He's a huge Batman fan and Joker fan. So the other thing is he would ask me about different versions of Joker or different characters and say, do you want him to be more like this or more like that? So he also has a huge wealth of knowledge where we could draw from different iterations of the character, which was really interesting.
Yeah, my mind immediately goes to Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo's Joker, who's wearing someone else's or his own face on his face, that kind of thing, which is really out there. Are there any other supervillains you would want to profile or take this route with?
Oh my gosh, I would love to profile many villains. The whole idea really came up because I wanted to do the Joker as young adult, as like a graphic novel for the young adult line, and then it became clear that it wasn't really appropriate for young adults.
Right.
But I love, and they said, but I remember Michelle Wells is my editor, and the head of the line said, "We're not really doing villains at the moment." And I was like, "Why? Who's that? Like, why aren't we doing villains?"
Cut to this summer, Year of the Villain.
I know. I'm telling you, I totally know.
That's funny.
I'm trying to think of who. You know, what I don't like are characters that have too many powers.
Uh-huh.
I would never want to do like a god villain, you know, like,
right.
I don't want to do Zod. I don't want to do anybody who has like uber powers.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's one reason why I actually like Batman. Because I like characters that have to be resourceful. You know, they might have some powers or abilities or skills, but they aren't so uber powerful that they're like, you know, they literally can defeat anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So I always feel like those are the ones that are the most fun to write because they can be beaten.
Right, right.
That's why I feel like, you know, Superman is an incredibly hard character to write. And I'm always amazed when I read these like really great versions, because I feel like when someone is so powerful like that, it's more challenging to come up with obstacles, you know, and ways to trip them up that don't seem silly.
You sound like the type of person who would like puzzles.
I'm very bad at puzzles, but I do like them.
Okay.
You know what it is? It's I have like some. I know a lot about very specific things.
Mm-hmm.
So like I know a lot about serial killers, but I know a lot about how to put together a thriller, but I can't solve an Agatha Christie like mystery solve, like to save my life, literally.
Gotcha.
Even when they go through it at the end, sometimes I'm still like, wait, what happened? So I don't think I could ever write these like thrillers have a mystery element, but I don't know that I could write a real mystery because there are almost like mathematical pieces that, you know, chess pieces at work.
Mm-hmm.
And with this, there are chess pieces, but they operate differently and they operate under the rule set of they have to match this profile and they have to be consistent with this type of a personality and this type of a criminal personality.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps me a little, you know, where the math fails me.
You know, it's funny. You were mentioning Batman, like a lot of his rogues, they're all just people that kind of, they have their little thing they do, but they're really just people behind the mask or whatever they're wearing, the top hat, say, for Riddler.
Yeah. I love Lex. I think Lex is like, I've always thought Lex is like a really interesting character. And then I remember I loved the original Superman movie so much when I was a kid. I watched it like
80
million times. And then when I got older and I was reading comics, it was very hard for me to not picture Lex Luthor as Gene Hackman. Because I was like, wait, what, you know, like this is not what he looks like. And I finally was like, oh, I just want him to look like Gene Hackman all the time.
Right.
But yeah, I like Lex a lot. I also like, I think one of the reasons I like Harley too, is I also like characters that aren't necessarily villains, but aren't always good either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that have like I love Constantine.
Right, right.
Like characters that are, you know, have a little like dark streak or unpredictable and can kind of go either way under certain circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Like I really love Constantine.
Yeah, I can't help but make a connection between Joker Harley and your book, The X-Files Origins, Agents of Chaos, in that one has the early, you know, a younger Mulder, and here we have, I assume, a younger Harley or youngish Harley. Is there, when you were doing both projects, are there any similarities of how you approach the work?
Well, Ed was also my consultant on that one.
Nice.
There's a serial killer in that. And then, so that one is now canon. Chris Carter made those canon. And my editor didn't tell me.
Oh like, my God.
Because she said, don't tell her, she won't be able to finish. Like she'll be too intimidated to finish writing it.
Right.
So I think, well, there's two things. One thing I learned with X-Files, which I already knew going in, which is why I think I got the gig, was because I don't want to destroy something that I like and like eviscerate it and make it into something new and unrecognizable.
Right.
So like, I don't want to take Joker and make him into like the mayor or something. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Like, or make him like a good guy. Like, I, you know what I mean? Like, I want to preserve the things that I love about the character. With Mulder, I very much reverse engineered him. So I said, when you're an adult, you know, when we're teens, obviously everything's amplified. Mm-hmm. So I thought to myself, like, we know how quirky and like kind of what his deal is as an adult. So if we rewind, what does that look like at 16 and 17? And so with Joker, it was very similar in the sense that I had this story that this kind of a pseudo origin story, because I still keep a lot of things a mystery, but it does show you some of his childhood. And I said to Ed, you know, this is what I want to do. And he said, well, we should profile him and see, like, well, what would he be like as an adult? And does he turn into the Joker that you want? Because that's how you know, that you've got the right kid. And so we were really doing it because I wanted to make sure that that the reverse engineering was working right. Mm-hmm. But then I ended up using it. So what I usually try to do is think about like how do you get this kind of person? So obviously with Joker, I know he's a psychopath. He has no remorse. He has no empathy. He can't love anyone. But there has to be more to him than that. So it's like, what ingredients go into making this thing? Because for me, if I can understand the pieces that I need, you know, the pieces of the ingredients in the recipe, I can make, like, I can figure out how to cook it, but I've got to know what goes into it in order to make this character feel super real. So the main thing that I did that was similar was with the reverse engineering, where I know what I want this person to be like as an adult. So what has to have happened to them for them to be that way, especially Harley, because she's not a psychopath. So she's, you know, it's like her personality is completely formed by her experiences. So like, what does she have to have gone through and what kind of knowledge does she need? What kind of education to be this person that I want to put on the page? And then it was cool because the more Ed and I played with it and talked through it, like the more she kind of evolved into like a real person. Like she became really real because then it was like she had a past, and I could kind of also predict the way she would behave in situations.
Right. That's really cool. Yeah. So it's almost like you can't fail because you've done all this homework to build up these characters from the ground up, or in another way, reverse engineer them.
Yeah. I mean, for me, that's the way it works because I have to know always kind of like, you know, what are they most afraid of? Mm-hmm. Or what do they want the most? You know, I feel like it always comes down to like, what do you want? What are you afraid of? Or, you know, what's your damage? I'm always interested in damage. You know, what's damaged someone and how?
Right.
All that informs like the kind of person that we become, the way you talk, the things you're interested in. So I want, you know, that's kind of where I start. And then I play around. I had to play around because, you know, she has some narrative in this. And I had to play around for a while to get the narrative the way, because it didn't sound the way I thought she would sound. Mm-hmm. And so I had to play with it until she did.
That's so cool. Are you looking forward to the response when this comes out October 9th?
I'm a little nervous. I'm talked Tom King into doing my first comic book event with me because I don't want to go by myself.
Nice.
You know, I've never written anything before where someone would be reading it while I was still writing.
Oh, true, true. Because it's so an ongoing.
Yes. And that's the part that's tricky. And I got some advice from Tom and Brian Michael Bendis and Mariko Tamaki and Margaret Stoll, who was my writing partner, who ended up writing, you know, Captain Marvel, you know, about periodicals, because to me, it's really intimidating, the idea that someone's reading it while I'm working.
Right.
Because even if they love it, I don't want that in my head. You know what I mean? I don't want that. I want the work to be separate.
Yeah.
So it's going to be tricky, but I'm just going to have to. The good news is I've already written, by the time it comes out, I'll have written the first four already.
Ah, nice.
So I'll be far enough in that, like, I can't really like change their personalities and mess up that badly. Mm-hmm. Or, and I also have Ed and my editor to be like, yeah, that doesn't, that's not going to happen. We don't like that.
Right. Yeah. I was talking to Rainbow Rao about this at San Diego Comic-Con this year. And cause she's done, you know, young adult graphic novels that come out all in one. And she's done obviously like Runaways, which is monthly, and you get like a hit of instant reaction. But as you just said, like you're 4 months ahead, you can't steer the ship even if you wanted to. Yeah, not that you would. So it's kind of a fascinating thing.
Yeah, I can't, especially because this thing, in order for this story to work, I mean, it had to be plotted out really specifically. And especially the murders and the end game and all of that. So if I tried to change it, it would become like it's like a house of cards. It would totally fall apart.
As far as the art, you've got two artists working, and they're, can you just talk a little bit about how you're working with them and how they're splitting up the work?
Yeah. So Miko Asuyan was the one that came on first. I saw his stuff online, and he's not in color, but he uses like gray, black, grayscale, right?
Mm-hmm. That sounds right.
Terminology. I don't know the color terminology until he says it. And then I'm like, what does that mean? And his work is really edgy. So I felt like he would be great for drawing like the present day Harley, the murder scenes, cops. Mm-hmm. But then I also knew that I was going to be telling this backstory about the Joker. And not only would I need someone else drawing the Joker, but I needed someone who could draw kids and teens and the Joker at different ages, which is not easy.
No.
And one of the things I really don't like is teenagers that look like just miniature adults.
Oh my God, I'm right there with you. I see it all the time.
Yeah. So shrunken adults. And I didn't find Mike. They gave me his name and said, we think you would love him. And I didn't even look at what they sent me. I just started went on Pinterest and started searching him. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things I hit, which I had weirdly seen at another time when I was doing something else, was his Mary Jane and his young Jean Grey. Which I think are remarkable.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, not only can this guy draw kids, he can draw girls, he can draw boys, he can draw teens. And he has an ability to draw very, very nuanced facial expressions that convey a lot of emotion. Mm-hmm. And the Joker is a budding psychopath who is not like putting that out there for all to see. So a lot of times, like the look in his eye is what is critical.
So
Mike's ability to, I mean, now obviously he draws an amazing murder scene too, but like his ability to tell the story through these like very subtle expressions, or also I love his montages, some of the layouts, you know, he will really play around and like come up with some really, really interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that, and the way he uses color, all of that was like, felt like the perfect complement that, you know, kind of not necessarily the opposite, but just like different enough from what Miko was doing that it was such a cool balance. Mm-hmm. And also very distinct. Like you're never going to look at one page and I didn't want a situation where you would not be, you would look at the page and not be sure whose it was.
Right.
I wanted it to be that like, the artists don't need their name on the page. Like you literally turn the page and you know which one of them drew it, so that it feels distinct. Like each person has their own territory, their own pages, and their own opportunities, you know, for their work to really stand out, because they are both remarkably gifted. And this would be an impossible story to tell without the right artists. It would never work.
The level of realism is just astounding. It really, and when you see a dead body in this book, you're like, oh, wow, this is dark. And it's perfect right now, right?
Oh, yeah. And Miko was like, you know, his sister's a nurse. He was like, what kind of stitches do you want?
Wow, that's cool.
You know, and Mike would say things like, I mean, like, you know, there's, you know, the one particular scene. He was just like, you know, well, what kind of, he would say things like, if she's in this position and then tilts her head, it wouldn't really do that. And I was like, what? Like, it was so technical. I had to like, you know, pretzel myself and try to figure out. And then I was like, oh my gosh, he's right. I know what he's saying now.
Wow.
But they both are just like top top of their game, and both like very unique and different from one another, which I think is cool.
Right.
Like having two people whose styles are really different but work nicely together.
Right. Like you said, you turn the page and you instantly know like you're somewhere else because of the style.
And every page, like I had picked out my favorite page of each of that was each of theirs, but then I was like, no, actually maybe I like this one. Mm-hmm. And then now that I've already started seeing stuff from issue two, I'm like, now I don't know what my favorite is. So one of the really cool things is that all of the murders, not that I'm suggesting this, but could be executed. Like they work.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Was there ever a case where like you were close to getting too far into like fictional areas?
Oh no, they work. Mm-hmm. They work. I mean, the things you would need would be challenging, but they actually all work.
Wow. What goes into that? A lot of research, I guess.
A lot of research and some research that's gross, like a lot of gross things on the internet that you have to look at to see what, you know, about burns and injuries and stuff. I definitely prefer to write about it and not look at.
It's like a different part of the imaginative brain to come up with probably a really disturbing murder.
It is. But again, like luckily, like actually doing these things would be incredibly like taxing and complex. So I'm less worried about I don't want to like make a how-to manual.
Right. Of course. Yeah.
Well, wait, when you see like the first ones, I mean, they look graphic, but they are very tame.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that was really important to me was I don't like the saggy middle. So they definitely amp up, like they get progressively more, darker and more complex. And I tried, to make them more visually interesting because the artists are so talented. So I was like, I'm going to give them a lot of hard work.
Put them through their paces. But in a way, you're making them better artists because they're drawing things they probably would have never thought they were going to draw.
Well, Miko loves horror and serial killer stuff. So he was so excited when I told him he was going to be drawing Vitruvian Man and dead bodies and stuff.
Yeah. This is why DC Black Label is so good, because it's allowing creators like you to kind of push the envelope.
And it was cool because, Jim Lee definitely, I know he could, but does not strike me as like he would want to be drawing some of this gross stuff. But he was totally into it. He was like, this sounds like it will look awesome. And I was just like, because, Jim draws like what I think of as like, cool, heroic and or like dark villains, but like, not melting body fat kind of thing.
Right,
not true crime-ish kind of thing, but it was so cool because just everybody, and he weighed in on the artists and like everybody's been really great. And obviously, and Mark Doyle has been great. My editor, Christy Quinn, is awesome because, there are a lot of things I don't know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So Richard Starkings is my letterer and he like gave me this entire because he wanted to like figure some of the lettering stuff out with me. And he gave me like this amazingly cool like lettering education all about like lettering and like the like emotions that different types of lettering evoke. It was so cool.
That is cool.
I know. So I felt like I learned, not that I'm ready to be a letterer, but I've learned all these really cool things and I can't necessarily do any of those jobs, but I feel like now like I understand because part of the trick with comics is that it's such a concert, everything has to work together and it has this kind of rhythm that you don't notice if you don't read comics.
Right.
But it's hard to pinpoint what the kind of the rhythm is. So it's like, it's cool. Cause then you get to kind of hear all the notes that go into the music. Cause like I was telling him like, I don't know what this is called, but I want it to do this. And he'd be like, oh, well that's blah, 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 blah. And I was like, okay, I want that.
That's awesome. Well, I am really excited to see what people say and think about this because I loved it. It really just threw me for a loop. I couldn't believe how realistic it looks and your depiction of Harley is just top notch. I can see that you put a lot of effort in building up this character and making them very real. And Joker Harley Criminal Sanity comes out number one. Sorry, Joker Harley Criminal Sanity number one comes out October 9th. Look for that. And if we could just move on to our last segment, off topic, top shelf. Cammy, I'm just curious, what is it something that you're interested in right now that's not comic related?
Well, I'm like a Netflix TV binge watcher, which I can never stop doing. I love to cook. I'm a really great baker. I make pie from scratch. Like my interests are very, like, don't like mesh well, like serial killers, pie baking, you know,
I'm sure there's a serial killer that's baked a pie with a person.
Yeah, but I don't put people in my pie.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
So I decorate, but there's no like Ed Gein, you know, like chairs made out of people or anything like that. But I mean, I could honestly watch, like, as much as I can read comics or read books, I'm just as addicted to television, mm-hmm. like good shows.
I'm sure everybody's wondering, like, are you watching Mindhunters?
Oh, are you joking? I've read Wrestler and Douglas's actual books.
Yes, like, yes.
And the person who helped come up with the classification system that they use in that, his name was, he passed away. His name was Roy Hazelwood. My consultant, Dr. Ed Kurtz, he studied with Hazelwood.
Wow.
So like
so, cool.
I know so much about Wrestler and Douglas, but I love that. I actually loved season one of True Detective.
Oh yeah.
Also.
Oh yeah. God, that was just like so iconic. Fantastic.
But then I also love like, you know, Stranger Things. So mm-hmm. it's like, it's not all like all serial killers all the time. Mm-hmm. I love Stranger Things. I can rewatch Buffy like endless numbers of times. I spend a lot of time at home in my pajamas with my dog.
Nice. That's how we all want to live.
Yeah. Spike and Oz, and we hang out, and I like to eat junk food. And I mean, I have kids also, but they go to school.
Yeah.
And then my son likes to cook. So I like to cook. And I like to eat, and I like to bake.
Great.
I don't know how to sew, though. It would probably be
it's too hard.
It would probably be like a seems like a handy skill.
I'm just too impatient for it. I can't handle that.
I know, but I don't like taking my stuff anywhere, so I could just fix it myself.
Oh my god,
seems good.
There's got to be YouTube videos for you. Are you going to be at New York Comic Con?
I am 100% going to be there. I'm actually
very cool.
Signing with Gabriel Piccolo. I'm signing Raven, and I'm signing. Joker Harley, Criminal Sanity, something like something I'll be signing because the mm-hmm. book isn't out yet with Miko at the booth. And I'm going to be on more panels. And this time, hopefully, I won't have laryngitis.
Oh, yeah. So that's right. I forgot about that.
That was so awkward on San Diego because I actually didn't sound as bad on the mic. But
no, you didn't. No,
I sound terrible unmiked.
That's rough. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Joker Harley, Criminal Sanity comes out October 9th. And Cami Garcia will also be at New York Comic Con. And thanks for listening.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, this has been fun.
Yeah, it was awesome.